In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
To the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'm going to be your host for today's fun little medical podcast. And today, we're going to be talking to two special guests, two people I really enjoy. First, I'm going to welcome back to the show Rax King, a writer who I really enjoy, whose books include Tacky and The People's Elbow. And you also have a newsletter and a podcast. Is that correct, Rax?
It's correct. I don't have a job, so I have to, you know, just keep myself busy by inflicting media on people from every angle I can think of.
Content.
Yeah, I'm Mrs. Content.
Your content is fantastic. Although I'm going to admit, I haven't listened to the podcast yet. I am going to. Can you tell me a little bit about what it is?
Can I? Yeah. So I will say, for anyone else who wants to get into my podcast, we're on, let's call it extended hiatus for right now, because my co-host, Amber Rollo, just had a baby. But it's called Low Culture Boil, and every week we dissect a different element of trash culture, pop culture, things of that nature. It's super fun. So yeah, you can't afford not to listen to my podcast.
Oh, I like a little threat there.
Yeah, I will find you.
And also joining us is, this might blow your mind, Ryan, but this is your 19th appearance on the House of Pod. Ryan Marino, Dr. Ryan Marino, toxicologist, ER doctor, overall good egg. Ryan, welcome back.
I am so glad to be back. I can't believe it's only 19.
I know. It's not enough. It is just not enough.
And I also cheers to 19 more.
Cheers. I also have to tell you, this is my 200th episode. And I can't think of two better people to have on for number 200 than you guys. So thank you for joining me. Today, we're going to talk about something that we have maybe discussed on the show before. Well, not maybe. We've discussed in different settings, but I thought it'd be fun to have you two on at the same time to discuss this topic, because we're going to come at it from two different angles, and I think it'll give us some different perspectives on something that's really important, and that is addiction. I'm going to talk about addiction in general, and then we're also going to talk about addiction and the physician, because Rax, you're not a doctor, technically. But
well, I would argue that I have a doctorate in cocaine use for sure. I've put in the field time.
Like pro level. You did the time. You did the work. I appreciate that. I will not take that from you.
But no, I'm not a doctor. I'm a writer.
But you have written about addiction a little bit in your newsletter, which, by the way, is fantastic. And we'll plug that. Make sure I don't forget to plug that. I really want to plug that at the end. But you've written about addiction, and you've written about sobriety as well. Let me start by asking you a question, the basic question. What do you feel you were addicted to, and when did you know?
Well, it's a kind of an interesting phenomenon. I mean, I have kind of done bootleg sobriety for, call it the past 10 years. I had a heroin problem when I was in college and kicked that. And people talk about how heroin is just like the hardest thing to kick. It's impossible. I really didn't find that to be the case. And I got cocky and then just kind of launched from there into having an Olympic grade drinking problem. And cocaine goes really good with drinking too much because it allows you to drink more without getting sloppy. So that just kind of came along for the ride at some point. And then all of that really makes it sound like I was just kind of happy-go-lucky tripping down the drug addiction fantastic. But really, that wasn't the case either, because both my parents, from the time I was born, were serious about AA. They were both really into AA. So the way I think of it, I really never didn't know I was going to have problems with addiction. I just kind of, you know, you can know that about yourself and still face it as like an inevitability when the time comes.
Well, you know, that's something that's really interesting about your writing. I didn't know it until recently when I was reading your newsletter, but because you've talked about your relationship with your father. It's a very sweet relationship. And in your newsletter, you write about how your father exposed you to his history of addiction, and he would take you to NA meetings, and you almost seems like you kind of grew up in that setting, you know, growing up in the corner while your dad's in the meeting with these other people. And he was very upfront with you. And I have a couple questions about that. Knowing that you had these parents that had a history of addiction and them being very upfront with you about it and being exposing you to it, did you almost feel like resigned to the fact that you were going to be an addict at some point yourself? Or did you, because I feel like it can go multiple ways when you're a kid of an addict. How did you feel in that situation?
Yeah, I think that I probably did have that sense of, well, this is coming for me. I mean, my parents always really emphasized that like alcoholism tends to be genetic and you see it, you know, in entire families a lot of the time. And so I did grow up with that in my head. But that said, I mean, you know, when you're a little kid, you just don't know what anything is, you know, you have to learn all of that stuff for the first time. And so even knowing that I would most likely have problems with addiction, I was still young enough that I didn't know what that meant. And like, I knew that both my parents were sober. They had told me so, but I didn't know what sober meant, really. I didn't mm-hmm. think, you know, I didn't put together that drugs and alcohol were the thing that they were sober from. I just had like all these kind of, I don't know how to describe it. Like, they would tell me stuff like that. I would go to my dad's meetings and I did pick up on how there was never alcohol in our house. Like, there might casually be alcohol in other people's houses, but I just didn't put any of the pieces next to each other. Like, I didn't know what sober meant, and I didn't really know what addiction meant. And at the same time, I kind of always envisioned that both those things would be part of my future.
Do you feel like your dad's goal in exposing you to it early was to protect you? Is that why he was like, I'm going to bring you to these meetings, I'm going to show you this so you are never in this position? Was that what he was thinking? And do you feel like it maybe helped you somehow in the long run?
Yeah, I definitely think it did help me in the long run. Honestly, my dad was like ever the realist about this stuff. I don't even know if he was optimistic enough to be like, I can protect my child from this. But I definitely think that he wanted me to know what my options were, you know, when the time came. And he probably wanted me to feel comfortable talking to him about it and things of that nature. You know, I don't know that he ever thought he could avert my becoming an addict. Maybe he did, but I think that he always wanted me to feel like it was just a comfortable topic. And I think I always kind of did.
Yeah. Like, he wanted to prepare you for it if you were to be, if you were ever to deal with it, you would know how. He wanted to give you sort of the tools almost for knowing how to then handle an addiction.
Yeah, and like he also would casually talk to me. I mean, once I was a little older, like a teenager, he would talk to me about the time he spent in the Betty Ford Center. And, you know, he and his friends would all of his friends had known him from the time that he was still doing stuff. And they would all joke about, like, what a fuck up he used to be. And so I was like, oh, okay, like this, there's a dark and scary side to this stuff, but it's not just grim the whole way through, which I actually think is maybe an important message to mm-hmm. give more generally about addiction, is that, like, yeah, it can really fuck up your life, but also you shouldn't be so afraid that it's going to fuck up your life that when it does start to fuck up your life, you just throw your hands up and you're like, I'm in it now, I might as well. Like, I think there's this real sunk cost fallacy that comes up for a lot of people confronting their own addictive behaviors.
You know, one thing I appreciate about you, Rax, that I've sort of like just noticed from our limited interactions together, is that you're very much a realist and you're very pragmatic, but not in a defeatist or depressing sort of way. And I bet you got that from your dad. And that sounds like the kind of thing that you sort of inherited, you know, from him, which is that you're like, okay, here is my situation. Kind of sucks. This part of it sucks. Here's how we're going to sort of deal with it and address it. Is that your mentality to sobriety, that, yeah, it's going to kind of suck. This whole situation is going to kind of suck, but I'm going to sort of deal with it this way. And this is because I've seen it done before. I know it can be done. I know you can recover and you can maintain sobriety. Is that something that you feel?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's also, you know, I'm in my 30s now and I'm kind of hitting an age where I'm not the only sober person anymore. Like, other friends are starting to join me. And something that I think actually really benefited me when I was making the decision to get sober and also sticking by the decision to get sober is that I just had it modeled for me by my father and also by my mother. I mean, my father was always, you know, a little more like, let's make a joke of it. All this stuff, you know, is just part of life. And my mom had been sober for less time than him and I think was a little less, just less inclined to tackle it from that angle. But either way, I mean, both of them were really committed to it. And to see that modeled for me when I was young was, I think, more helpful than not. But also, both of them came at it pretty much exclusively from the rooms of AA. Like, that was the bedrock of their sobriety for both of them. And I don't go to AA myself. So I think that, you know, that pragmatic part of myself definitely does question that decision and definitely does, like, wonder if I'm doing sobriety wrong based on everything that I learned about it when I was young. But I think by and large, it really doesn't pay to make more of a melodrama out of trying to get sober than it already has to be. I mean, I definitely had some really dark times with it and I found it really difficult. And there are times even now when I still get tempted by the demon rum, but I think that a dose of, like, perspective and pragmatism is critical, or at least has been critical for me in maintaining a little distance from the story of sobriety and just pursuing it on my own terms, if that makes sense.
One thing that I really like about the story about you and your father's relationship and how he kind of, like, exposed you to this and taught you about things is just that there is this positive side to kind of substance use addiction and that journey that gets overlooked so much. The focus is always on, like, overdoses and deaths and people ending up addicted and it hitting rock bottom and all of that stuff. And the actual data is that most people who use drugs don't end up with addiction. Most people who end up with addiction recover on their own. They don't even get any help from anyone. And so it is really kind of like that community is just so positive in itself. And it's something that I feel like most people who are not part of it or don't interact with it, don't actually know, and the narratives are just so skewed.
I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And I mean, even like the really dark stuff that can come up for people who are in active addiction, like I have overdosed before. And I mean, looking back, you know, the circumstances of it were really funny to me in retrospect. Like so much of this stuff you hear over and over, like a drug overdose is the worst thing in the world. Addiction is the worst thing in the world. And if it befalls you, like, good luck to you. But honestly, like a lot of my experiences with having different drug problems, like I look back and I'm glad that I don't have those problems actively right now, of course. But there's a lot of humor in all that stuff. And there's, you know, even for people who can't find it funny, I mean, I'm kind of a gross weirdo in that way. But even if you don't find it funny, like recovering from addiction isn't all darkness, and it isn't all that classic AA story of like, you were at rock bottom, but you saw the light. It's a very Christian story, which is not my bag at all. But like, it's not all about that. It's about lightness too. And it's about finding positive community and not just leaving behind negative community. Like there are a lot of upsides to sobriety that aren't just this dramatic, like save my life kind of thing. Like there's a lot to be said for sobriety other than it's the only option left to you.
Yeah. I love that we can have multiple different types of conversations about addiction, and not all of them have to be incredibly dark, and not all the stories have to be 100% sorrow in them. And you can still look back and see some bits of joy in the story, even as you reach sobriety. I think, honestly, I've said this before, but I think there is an addiction out there for everybody. If you haven't been exposed to it yet, you're just lucky enough that you haven't, but there's something for everyone. For you, like, you know, heroin wasn't really the bugaboo. Maybe it's rum more so than heroin for you. But like, you know, for some people, it's going to be different. And we need to be able to discuss it in multiple different ways. And everyone needs to hear about it in ways that don't include just AA or that like traditional Hollywood story of hitting rock bottom and then seeing the light and being saved. And that's great for people who it works for. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to be everyone's journey through sobriety. And so we should share those stories, too. I think that's really important.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the Hollywood story, because I think it is so funny every time you see a biopic of a musician or someone who was famously a drug addict. It's the fucking same every single time, right? All the beats are exactly the same. He hits rock bottom. He goes to rehab. He thrashes around in a twin size bed for a while. He's got the sweats or the shits or something. It's just like you can predict it shot by shot almost.
Right. You can't walk the line.
Yeah.
And they say the line that's the title of the movie.
You know? Yeah. And that's how everyone thinks of like heroin, is like rock bottom. Someone like the worst point of their life, like risking it all, whatever, shooting up under a bridge. And I mean, how many people have had like the worst things of their life from Chardonnay or like an IPA? And
right.
I mean, most people I know who have used heroin like don't have those kind of same stories. So it is really skewed how it's not just Hollywood, but those Hollywood perceptions are definitely interesting. And
yeah.
I never thought of it. J.D. Vance book and movie too.
That's right. Oh, that's right. Oh, that guy sucks.
That guy totally sucks. I mean, it's interesting that you put it that way. I hadn't thought of it before, but it is a very Christian sort of thing that like he was at his bottom and then he saw the light, and through God's will or whatever, he rose up and he was able to cast off the demons of the addiction. Let me ask you a question here. How long has it been for you? How many days sober are we talking?
In terms of exact days, I don't know, but I know I got sober on April 25th, 2022. That's from alcohol and cocaine. For heroin, it is 2014 sometime.
What happened on that date, the 2022 date?
Well, you know, that's kind of the thing, actually. I didn't have one of those thrashing around in rehab moments. I woke up and I was hungover and I woke up late and, you know, I had been doing blow all night, so it, you know, my nose hurt and I was all stuffy and gross, and I just said to myself, like, I can't do that again. And I had actually, I mean, for drinkers especially, because alcohol is legal and it's everywhere and it's socially encouraged a lot of the time, when you're a problem drinker, you're probably going to say, I will never drink again, like twice a week.
Right.
Anytime you have a hangover, you know, or anytime you throw up and you're feeling that kind of low, embarrassed feeling, you're going to say that to yourself. But I guess I just happened to mean it this time, and I mm-hmm. haven't had a drink or had any cocaine since.
Oh, that's fantastic. Let me ask you this, you know, because your dad was so upfront with you. I know recently you got married. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And if you end up having kids, if that ends up being what you do, are you going to share with them as openly as your dad shared with you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that it's one of the most helpful and generous things that my dad could have done for me. I mean, he was like kind of a secretive guy. Generally, that really runs in my family. It's you will be finding shit out about people in my family decades after they die. But he really, I think, made a point of treating that part of his life with openness. And also something that he modeled for me that I hope I can model for my kids someday is not being embarrassed about it, because I think there's still this perception that addiction is embarrassing and it's private. And I think it certainly does play out that way, like for the addict in the moment. I definitely didn't want people to know or to sense that I was having cocaine problems, because they would have told me to stop and I didn't want to stop. But beyond that, I mean, I don't think that shame or secrecy around it is helpful for anybody. I actually think that the more diverse array of addictions that we can see somewhat publicly, like the more people will be able to recognize it for themselves and make informed decisions for themselves.
Yeah, that's really well said. Speaking of well said, I really enjoy your writing, and if you don't mind, I'm going to read an excerpt from your newsletter, if that's okay.
Do it, yeah.
I think it's
excerpt.
I'm going to excerpt right now. I'm going to excerpt like a pro here. The first couple of weeks of sobriety are boring and dreary in predictable ways. The problem is that I don't want them to be the same old boring, dreary, sober weeks that everyone else has to tolerate. At parties, I smile like a baboon grinning his aggression through his teeth. I ask bartenders for syrupy seltzer concoctions and rocks glasses and seethe with my pink water. My friends go to the bathroom too often and talk at me too fast. They smash beer cans and stink of yeast. It's all humiliatingly familiar. I tell Sean he can drink. Don't worry about me. I'm fine with it. But he does drink, and I'm not fine with it. I hate that they're all having fun doing this, and I hate that I'm not. Sober, I'm a bad sport. How did I read that? Did I read that with the inflection that you would have liked? Or did I?
Totally, oh yeah, screw? No, okay. You sound just like okay. me. Actually,
I feel like we're. It's like looking in a mirror.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this: how do you? Because sobriety is going to be so hard, particularly when you're engaging with people in your past that are still actively using. And I could see this is such a good description of that irritation it must feel like. How do you recommend people manage it? Should they just avoid it? Should they just avoid those triggers? Should they avoid those people? Or do they have to expose themselves to it and then just somehow deal with it? How do you recommend people handle this?
You know, that's a good question. And I will say too that probably the biggest difference between quitting heroin and quitting drinking has been the emergence of that irritability, because quitting heroin, it was so easy for me to not hang out with my junkie friends anymore because they only ever wanted to do the one activity and that wasn't what I was doing anymore. So we just had nothing in common, super easy to cut ties. Maybe that sounds callous, but whatever, like when you're on heroin, it makes you pretty callous.
Yeah.
And with drinking is everywhere and it's socially accepted and it's socially encouraged, and you know, you're probably not gonna go to most parties and hang out in mixed company and there's a bunch of people shooting up just casually, but every single party pretty much has people drinking. And I was definitely irritable about that for a long time. It felt unfair. And it did go away, mostly. I will say, something that continues to irk me, that will probably irk me in some form for the rest of my life, people get drunker than they think they do, a lot faster than they think they do. After like one or two drinks, people are loosening up in a way that isn't always annoying, but, you know, oftentimes. And I mean, many of those same friends that I wrote about that you just quoted me being irritated with, like, I still hang out with all those people, and I'm not so annoyed by the fact that they drink and even do cocaine. I prefer that they don't do that latter thing in front of me, but that's avoidable enough. And I would say that, I mean, you know, your mileage may vary, but I think that if you can stick out those feelings of like left outness and irritation, you're gonna find that a lot of the feeling left out was kind of in your head. Like, people by and large don't care that much whether you're drinking or not. But you'll also, you know, because it's in your head, you'll be able to work through it in time, and you'll be able to ask yourself, why does it matter to me that these people are doing something that they think is fun that I quit doing because it stopped being fun? Like, why is that a problem for me? And I mean, interrogating that response of mine was actually really helpful for me in a lot of ways. And, you know, I can't pretend it never, ever hurts when my friends are just getting blasted in front of me. It hurts. It still isn't that fun, but I can also like hang out with people who are casually drinking and it's not a problem anymore. I think if you stick with it, you'll find your balance too.
So I love your discussion. And I mean, your writing is so good. But I love your discussion of those feelings of kind of like resentment almost. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, that's right.
but like being annoyed at that and stuff. But beyond that, even just the way that alcohol is so not even just like acceptable, but it's like a part of the culture and like everyone. I mean, you gotta take a drink. Why aren't you taking a shot? That kind of thing. Yeah. And so, like, I mean, heroin, yeah, it's totally easy to separate that from kind of like any sort of socialization if you need to. But it is really weird to me always how we treat these different drugs in just completely different ways. And I mean, I think even more recently, like, alcohol has taken on more of that. It's kind of like the weekend warriors, whatever. Work hard, play hard, what all of these things that are just part of our society. It is weird, and it annoys me too.
Like, I mean, we're annoyed at our friends that are drinking even when we're drinking with them, Rax. So
drinking people are annoying. Y'all get so loud sometimes. But I actually think that, like, yeah, to your point, Ryan, there's this like really like winking and obnoxious way that alcohol gets discussed just culturally. Like, my husband and I just now, we were watching us a little bit of Great British Bake Off, as you do. And the joke, like every other round of Great British Bake Off, Jesus, is that Mary Berry, this like 80-year-old woman who's one of the judges, is just a flagrant alcoholic. And like, anytime a cupcake or whatever has a little booze in it, she has to be like, oh, you know, I like that because I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just like, why is that the mode that alcohol gets discussed in? Like, it's this mode of, I know it's bad for me, but it's so good. Like, why that and not heroin?
Right, because everyone drinks and not everyone does heroin. And that's you're absolutely right. It is funny in our culture. It's like, oh, your girlfriend broke up with you. Come on, let's get a drink. Oh, yeah. Something great happened. You got a promotion. Let's go get a drink.
It's yeah. Like, you know, anytime anything happens.
Yeah.
And not to be like a conspiracy theorist here, but I think that's a big win for the alcohol industry. I think they did that on purpose, very much so. yeah. And so, I mean, even like if your boss wants to buy you a drink, if you say no, like, wow, you're turning down a drink from your boss. That's so terrible. But like,
bad for your career a lot of the time.
Yeah, but imagine if your boss was like offering you a bump or something. I mean,
I'm sure in the 1980s that happened a lot. So
yeah, I mean, maybe people should seek out those jobs because
is that Wall Street? Is that still happening? Is that still a thing? Yeah. It is interesting though, because you really got a glimpse of seeing alcohol use from a different perspective. You also, and people are going to maybe think this was a little bit crazy, you took a part-time job at a bar in your sobriety, in the middle of your sobriety, which does sound a little sadomasochistic, but yeah. I mean, it probably gave you a much different perspective on seeing people drink.
Yeah, it did actually. And, it was funny, you know, I took this job in the bar, and of course they don't ask you when they're interviewing you, like, by the way, do you drink? So I just kind of pretended that I wasn't sober for a few weeks, and then it just became unavoidable. The bartenders, you know, before they have you run drinks, they ask you to taste them to make sure that they're right. And I was just like, I can't do that. I'm sober. And everybody was like, why didn't you just say something, weirdo? And I think I didn't say something because I was trying to leave that door open for myself a little bit, you know, just in case. Because part of the reason that I wrote about my sobriety, part of the reason that I tweeted about it a lot and everything, is I didn't want to leave that door open for myself, because I had left the door open every other time that I'd told myself I'm never going to drink again. And what do? I drink again. Like, I wanted people kind of watching me, and I wanted to have to stick with it for my own pride, pretty much. And so at the bar, when I finally closed that door, it was kind of a sad feeling. And then I paid more attention to our clientele, who were, you know, just Williamsburg professionals. I mean, just a bunch of like bourgeois, middle class, very nice, mostly people. But I would watch them get like wasted and sloppy and loud and annoying and handsy and like vomit into their pint glasses. Some of these people with job titles like, you know, content president or stuff that is like very made up, whatever, like really middle class, respectable people, and they're partying like frat boys. And I'm kind of like, at a certain point, okay, I actually do not miss this. There was this moment, oh my God, I was waiting in line for the bathroom, and I see out of the corner of my eye this shape advancing on me, and it quickly becomes apparent that I am being cornered by the cokehead girl in line for the bathroom. Mm. And she just talks at me for like 90 uninterrupted seconds about how much she likes my sweater. And I'm like, holy shit, this is the first time I have ever not missed cocaine. This is the worst thing ever. Like, is this what I sounded like? And of course it is.
Oh, well, what a good perspective to get. And speaking of sloppy, loud, annoying, and handsy, we're going to take a quick break for our ads, and we'll be right back.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
We're back. So let me ask you a different question here. And I know this is going to sound like a silly question, but do you like being congratulated on sobriety?
Oh, yeah. That's the only reason to do it. No, it's not the only reason, but it's awesome. People, and I really like that people who aren't sober think it's just the biggest deal. Like, they go quiet and they almost want to thank me for my service, you know? And I just love that. I live for that shit. Not everyone does it, and it sucks. I think everyone should have to congratulate me all the time.
Yeah,
Do you think any of those people know like what the work is to be sober or like be in recovery? That's what I'm not a person who's like sober or in recovery, and it drives me crazy to see the kind of like self I don't know what the word I'm thinking of, but the like congratulatory expressions as if it's like, oh, like thanks for your service.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm joking. I definitely don't expect everyone to congratulate me, but I think that there is this sometimes when people do congratulate me or make a big deal of it and they're not sober themselves, I think there's this kind of implied, like, I could never do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like that tone, actually. I don't really, it makes me feel a little
alien,
othered. Yeah, alien. Yeah. Like I'm a specimen. Like it's not, weird. I mean, it's so hard. It's not weird. That hard. Yeah. Like how, oh, wow. Okay.
How can I even relate to you? You're not even drunk.
It's you know so who weird. Does that, like, is the worst, is, and I'm so sorry, this is so racist, but British people are the worst about it, because
you can say
Britain
anything
is...
you want about British people. It's totally, I think that's yeah. the one last group where it's super cool with everyone.
It's just such a drinking country, like more yeah. than here. I don't know, honestly, if I could ever go back to England, because I mean, everyone that I know there, I know from getting way too drunk together. And every time I've been there, it's not even a question. In America, it's a question. Are you drinking? You go to Britain, it is never a question. And if you're not drinking, people assume either that you're dying, probably not even, because if you're dying, you would definitely be drinking. Or I don't know, just some kind of insane psycho murderer who's staying sober so he can pick out a victim or something.
That feeling of being othered, I think that's really interesting, is that people start to put you in a different category. There's all the rest of us who drink, and then there's Rax over there
yeah.
who doesn't drink for whatever reason. You know, the thing I want to talk about next, and I know Ryan has some thoughts about this, so we've got it. I want to hear what he has to say, but let me ask you first, did you ever go to AA or any similar sort of meeting, and if not, why?
I went one time to an in-person AA meeting. I went once on Zoom, and that was a disaster. And I went once in person, and it wasn't a disaster. It was just, I went in person in a moment where I was really struggling with my sobriety, and I think I was kind of expecting it to be a revelation, and it wasn't one, so I didn't go back to that meeting either. I'm not going to rule out going, because I do think there could be a lot of value for me in a room full of people all in more or less the same boat as me. I think that socially that could be really useful for me, and I think I could be useful for them. That's a big part of why AA exists. But I really have no desire to go, if I'm honest. I don't think that's in the cards for me for a while yet, if any time.
I can see the loss of that to the other people, because you do have a lot of insight. I mean, you have a writer's sort of like mind thinking of stuff, and you're probably going to come at things from a different angle. But I mean,
it's so sad for them, because I'm basically the smartest person in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ever born.
Yeah. Well, they have this podcast at least to listen to.
Yeah.
So, they have that. Ryan, let's hear your thoughts about AA. Should Rax go to AA?
I have a lot of opinions on AA, and I have to be careful what I say, because if you say the wrong thing about AA, you can get canceled. We know that cancel culture is the biggest threat to humanity. But no, I mean, AA is very successful because it does have something to offer. I think what it has to offer and what it thinks it has to offer are very different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, for me, I would never push AA on someone, and I would actually never even recommend it unless someone asked about it. But I think like the sense of community and support and that kind of stuff, especially because it's such a massive organization, they have so many resources, that's like really unmatched. And I hope that someday in kind of like substance use, there can be places where people can have like conversations and can have support and talk to other people about those kind of things outside of the context that AA has, that I see as a little problematic, which is that it's very religious. and also just kind of like a weird thing in itself. I mean, if you've ever been to an AA meeting, like they push very strong coffee on you. They have a lot of like cigarette breaks, like smoke as many cigarettes as you want, because at least it's not alcohol. And I mean, NA is very similar as well. And in terms of, you mean like for opioids, there's very good evidence-based medicines to treat like opioid use, opioid withdrawal. And NA doesn't recognize any of those, even the one that completely blocks opioids, Vivitrol or naltrexone. So it's a lot of just like weird, like logical fallacies kind of, and like counterintuitive thinking, and almost like delusionality to me from that regard. But it is a really supportive place. And so, I mean, for me, when I did medical school, my like training, the only training that I got on substance use was I was required to go to multiple AA meetings. And so looking back on, like, that wasn't that long ago. I'm not that old, I hope. But
pretty old.
But that's kind of crazy to me, and I don't know that like that much has really changed, because from a medical evidence perspective, AA and these 12-step programs do not have any benefit of like getting people into sustained recovery, preventing deaths, that kind of thing. And so I'm not here to say that they don't have any benefit, because they definitely do have a lot of other benefits. But as kind of like a medical, from the medical side, as a treatment intervention, yeah, that's still kind of like where we are, I think.
Yeah, you know, we talked about this, Ryan, you and I, when we interviewed the late author David Poses for his book The Weight of Error, about his addiction and why AA didn't, you know, or NA didn't work for him. And I agree. I think that for some people it does seem to work very well, but there's a religious component or a spiritual component at best that I don't think works for a lot of people. And it does sort of neglect, and maybe this is not on them, but maybe it's on the rest of society to remember this, that it does neglect that sometimes we need to focus on medical treatments, mm-hmm. Instead of just these things, and that you can't be expected to just, for some people, maintain sobriety or reach sobriety without some medical assistance for alcohol or for other drug abuse too. I find that sort of an interesting concept that I only learned about, I think, relatively recently, because I think growing up, like, we always thought you have to go to AA. Like, if you're an addict, you go to AA. That's it. That's the only way to do it. I feel like there's other groups. Are there other non-spiritual versions of AA that maybe bring in more of a medical perspective, a psychiatric perspective? Is there something like that that's widely available? Or is that kind of maybe just on a case-by-case basis, Ryan?
Not really. I mean, like, support groups and that kind of thing are definitely growing, and especially on like the grassroots level. And for, I mean, people who use drugs, that's really kind of like all there is at this point, is other people are kind of providing the support that doesn't exist anywhere else. And on the flip side of this discussion is how kind of the like over medicalization of substance use is also really problematic. And I mean, like, the medical recovery industry, detox, rehab, whatever you want to call it, is really problematic as well, and is like mostly non-evidence-based scammy stuff, whereas like AA, at least, it's people who like are trying to do good. Whereas, yeah, I mean, on the medical side, there's a lot of like very, very bad stuff that still happens. And I mean, even things like petting dolphins and like doing yoga with goats are reimbursed by like Medicaid, at least as of very recently. And so, yeah, there's just, it's hard because it's a big gap that people need. Like, if you're going through something, if you're trying to stop using a substance every single day, whatever, talking to someone about it, like having something to do, is definitely going to help. And on the one hand, you have this kind of like cult. And on the other hand, you can like get put in $1,000 a day rehab where they don't do anything because they want you to come back again. So.
Yeah, I mean, my sense has long been, and Ryan, maybe you can either confirm or deny this to some extent, but that void that you're talking about, where nobody seems to have a perfect handle on what people need when they're struggling with addiction. I mean, that very void is a big part of why people struggle for so long and in so much silence. And I think also there's probably a lot of truth to this idea that AA really kind of shits on, that you do use drugs because there are so many things going wrong in your life that you have no control over. And the less control you have, the more attractive an escape looks. I mean, people, you know, you get on Twitter, every other post these days is something like, you know, some blue check jerk off complaining about homeless people, you know, taking your money and getting high with it. And it's like, what do you want that guy to do? He doesn't have a home. What is he supposed to do all day except be high? Like, there's, I think, this real denial among AA devotees, and maybe in the medical world too, of just how much circumstance plays a role in why people use and how much they're going to keep using unless there's a change in circumstance.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And I think, I mean, those are like objective facts. And I would take it even one step further. And not only does like AA deny this, but most of the medical profession denies the fact that people using substances a lot of the time is self-medication. And people have very legitimate reasons. And in a lot of situations, I mean, if someone couldn't self-medicate, like the outcome could be much, much worse.
Let's shift gears a little bit here to talk about these issues in the physician population in particular, and talk about the impaired physician. So I'm Ryan, I'm sure you can talk to this better than I can, but the American Medical Association defines an impaired physician as one who is unable to fulfill professional or personal responsibilities because of a psychiatric illness, alcoholism, or drug dependency. And I was trying to figure out numbers on this, but an estimated 10 to 15% of physicians are impaired at some point during their careers, according to the AMA, the American Medical Association. That seems like an extraordinarily high number. Does that seem right to you? Low or what?
It's really hard to say. I mean, that seems right to me. And I think, I mean, even just getting into the like verbiage that the AMA uses, which the AMA, they really need to step it up, but like we don't use the word alcoholism anymore. Like, that's not productive. And so these things are like those aren't even objectively defined terms. Just a few decades ago, it was normalized to have the like 2 martini lunch and then like go back and do surgery or whatever.
Oh my god.
And I think, I mean, my experience and like everyone I know in healthcare is that like drinking culture is a very big part of that. And so, I mean, I think it again comes down to these arbitrary distinctions between like some things are okay. And so like if you binge drink on the weekend, that's totally normalized. But like, God forbid you develop like a opioid use disorder. And so in not just for the AMA, but for your like state medical license, you have to declare if you have like a substance use problem, and then you have to follow up, go through all of these additional hoops and hurdles. And if, God forbid, you wanted to go into recovery with like methadone or buprenorphine, and even the naltrexone, again, literally something that blocks opioid effects from getting into your body completely. Those are, I think, like still for the most part banned nationwide. These all come down to kind of state medical boards, and for like your specialty, whether it's nursing or whatever. But yeah, that's a really big problem. And yet, like, you can take your trainees out for shots, and that's like medical education.
Let me ask you, Rax, again, not technically a doctor, but what medical fields would you feel have the highest risk for impairment for addiction of some sort? What would your guess be?
You know, as y'all have been talking, I'm like, I think I had one of these. I think I had a doctor who I thought at the time was just a bad doctor, but now I'm looking back and I'm like, that guy was shithouse drunk every time I saw him. And he, I'm sorry to say, Kaveh, was a gastroenterologist, so I think maybe anyone who, like, their patients are anesthetized a lot of the time they see them, probably you can get away with being a little bit, you know, fucked up. Because they're not going to, you know,
you don't notice they're sleeping.
They're asleep, yeah.
You know, oddly enough, it's not GI doctors. We probably have other issues, but the two that are most associated are anesthesiology. For the reason you mentioned, they are, like, and they have probably the most access to these drugs. That's one of the reasons. Although there are some other theories I've read about with them. Ryan, I don't know if you heard about this one, but there was that theory that they were kind of exposed to, like, low levels of, like, gases because of their work. And then they slowly grow an addiction, and then they go home. They try to basically feed that. I don't know if there's anything
to that.
That's
horrible. Jesus. Yeah.
And then the other one is emergency medicine, Ryan. Kind of what you do. Does that sound right to you?
The emergency medicine part,
yeah.
The anesthesia part, that's
that's
bullshit.
Oh, it's not. It's not true.
Them being exposed to low level.
Right. Yeah.
There's so many other people in those rooms every day who are exposed don't go in the bathroom and inject propofol, but
or fentanyl.
That's not a good one. I don't think.
Yeah, that's not a fun one.
That's not.
Actually,
not even fun.
Listen to our episode we did with an anesthesiologist named Faye Jamali, this nice Persian soccer mom who is an anesthesiologist, broke her ankle and got a little extra medication to treat it. And before she knew it, she was slamming, like, extraordinarily high doses of IV fentanyl in the bathroom. It's just insane. How quickly it could happen, you know, and I found that very interesting that, you know, that was an eye opener for me, because that was just like, you know, that was pretty hitting close to home. So that one was really eye opening to me. So I guess I'm not too shocked that the number is 10-15% of physicians. It just seems that we would hear about it more. What's happening in these cases, Ryan, let me take a step back. What should people do if they suspect that a colleague is impaired or drunk or having some issue that's fucking up their medical work? What should other physicians do?
Well, so that's really the problem here. Obviously, I mean, if someone is impaired at work and involved in patient care, then, like, you have to protect those patients. That is what comes first. But in terms of what you do about that person and kind of in the long term, kind of methods to deal with this, like, don't really exist. If you tell anyone, if you report them, then usually they are, like, mandated to certain treatment courses, or if this is not their first time, or if it's something more severe considered, like heroin, God forbid, then they might just lose their license and lose their ability to practice, or go on probation or something like that. And so, I mean, I know physicians who have been impaired at work, and have had kind of suffered these horrible consequences. And not to say that being impaired at work is okay, but there's no good system for dealing with it. And we're not helping these people get better in any way. We're kind of just, like, kicking them to the curb. And so even someone who on their own were to seek out, I mean, like, Suboxone or methadone treatment, if they disclose that, they could just lose their license. The problem is that we need to kind of be more supportive of this and have, like, these conversations about substance use, about how we take all of the department out on the weekend and do rounds of shots together.
Your but department is cooler than mine, by the way. We're not
just
we're
doing
not drinking
shots
together.
All the time.
I see where the problem with ER is here.
I can't do shots. I'm too old for that.
Yeah, you are. You're very, very old. Very old.
So those are just hypotheticals. But yeah, I mean, it should be okay for someone to like acknowledge that they have a problem. It should be okay for them to want to get help. Yeah. And we should, I mean, as a medical profession, if we're saying that like the medical treatment for this is one thing, and then we're not even offering it to our own, I can't tell you how many like nurses, doctors I've interacted with, met and know who have been denied either their career or like legitimate treatment that they wanted. And that is really messed up to me.
I agree. It's very tricky and it's very hard because on one hand, we do need to support them, especially if someone's trying to get help. We have to help them find ways to do that so they can maintain a career and recover. But on the other hand, the AMA recommendation, you know, is, you know, you don't talk to them. You just deal with it. You take tickets to management and you let it be known. And I have to say, because of the fact that we almost all deal with patients, that makes sense to me too. Like, I feel like that's what you have to do. If there's someone out there who's in the hospital who deals with patients and they're not able to make good decisions because they're impaired in any way, that I feel like that's a red line for me. But at the same time, I absolutely agree with what you're saying, which is that these people we need to be able to get them help. They need to be able to find ways to get help. That
comes down to the definition of impaired and the way that medicine, healthcare does like testing and defines that. And I mean, it's the same way that we do it to patients with like these shitty tests for drugs and everything. And so, I mean, like my biggest role in this is, I mean, interpreting drug tests probably, and they're all garbage. So, I mean, if someone is like gets screened at work for impairment and they have a positive drug screen, that doesn't mean they're impaired at all, but then that gets counted down as impairment that goes on like whatever their license. They have to report it every year. They have to do mandatory follow-up treatment, whatever. And it's because, I mean, healthcare doesn't even know how to deal with drugs. The profession of medicine can't interpret a simple urine drug test. That's like probably one of the things I deal with most in my job is how bad doctors are at interpreting a urine drug screen.
Yeah, it is. It is actually vague too, the way it's worded. This is what I pulled up from the Medical Board of California. BPC, that's like a business practice code or something like that. BPC code section 2280 prohibits a physician from practicing medicine while under the influence of any narcotic drug or alcohol to such an extent as to impair their ability to conduct the practice of medicine safely to the public and their patients. So it's a bit vague. I mean, there can be no narcotic or drugs. It's like saying narcotic drug or alcohol to the extent it impairs their ability to do it. So, I mean, I'm not quite sure how to interpret that. I mean, it sounds like is they need some test that comes back positive and then somebody who feels they were impaired. Is that how it's working, Ryan? Like how are they determining if someone's impaired?
Yeah, the determination of impairment is not really, I mean, it's not defined. There are different definitions that can be applied. Like fitness for duty, you can say you think someone's impaired, have fitness for duty testing. And I mean, if they have like THC in their urine because they smoked marijuana and live in a state where that's legal and they did it outside of work, I mean, that can be considered impaired at work. And it is the same as like, I mean, someone getting pulled over and doing like a field sobriety testing without having like an alcohol level or whatever for things like marijuana. These are all very subjective, and I would say like approaching 100% of the time, they're not interpreted correctly and they're not even applied correctly. And it blows people's mind when I tell them that a urine drug screen like being positive for something doesn't matter at all. A urine drug screen being negative for something, the person could be the most impaired person in the world, and test negative for everything that you look for. So
what's the one?
It's thing not we, well defined.
So if we had to change something in this regards into treating or to dealing with the impaired physician, what would that thing be? Would it be better testing that's more accurate? Would it be a better system of catching it early? Would it be better support systems for the impaired physician to sign up for safely before it becomes a problem? What would be the one thing that would be the best?
It would be better support systems. If it is related to an impairment, allowing someone to kind of like admit to that or whatever, seek out help so that they can keep their job, I think would be much better than having people try to hide this.
Do you feel like there are specific challenges to treatment of doctors with addiction that the general public doesn't face, or do you feel that there are that the treatment's different in any way?
Yeah, that. So I'm glad you brought that up, because the biggest problem in terms of, so not to focus just on opioids, because like I hate only focusing on opioids. There's so many other things to talk about, but they're the easiest example, and everyone knows that like there's a big opioid problem going on, and we have really good evidence-based treatments for opioids. So a healthcare professional who says they're buying Percocet on the street, buying fentanyl, taking home opioids, whatever it is, they are mandated to sobriety. They oftentimes are mandated to like AA or NA. And we have like very good evidence-based medicines that the healthcare profession has been trying to push for years. I mean, these are underutilized. We need more people to have access to these things. That's why so many people are dying out in the public. And then on the back end, like, you're not allowed to be on Suboxone as a physician, as a nurse. You're not allowed to be on methadone and have a professional healthcare license. And that is kind of really, I mean, the hypocrisy there is mind-blowing to me. But it's because people have this belief that like you would be impaired if you're taking a medicine. And at the end of the day, that's just like the same shitty bias and stigma that is blocking people from accessing these medications across the board. Someone who's on methadone every day, who's on Suboxone, is not impaired. And so the definition of impairment is just so subjective. And
I would like to actually just step in with an example that came up for me as Brian was talking. There is a person in my life who I'm not going to say who it is and not going to blow up their spot, but there's a person who I love very much who for like decades has had problems with heroin and problems with opioids in general, and finally was able, through a treatment plan that he was on for a while, he was able to take Suboxone. And it was life-changing. I mean, his longest ever streak of not using heroin was during his Suboxone treatment. And that went on for a while. And then he had to stop taking Suboxone for a job. And within months was in jail for fucking heroin, obviously. And it's just, it's maddening. Because I took Suboxone when I wanted to quit heroin. It was magical. And, you know, it just does so much good. I've seen anecdotally over and over what a miracle it is for people who spend years just in the doldrums of junk addiction. And it's just, it's really maddening to me in particular that even in the medical community, the very medical community where the Suboxone is like tested and prescribed and everything, You can't take it, or you could lose your job, lose your license even. That's so fucked up.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan and I have seen this and among some of our friends, and we've seen the results, and they can be disastrous. So I absolutely agree. It seems like an easy enough fix. I think at the root of it, a major problem, and this is my guess as to why this is an issue and why this is still something that gets caught up is that people in the medical profession still don't truly view addiction as a medical problem. They don't deal with it the same way, think of it the same way as it was diabetes. So, for example, if someone came in with metformin, I'm not going to be mad at them for being on metformin for their diabetes. I'll be like, okay, good, you're getting your diabetes treated. I'm not saying, like, why can't you lose the weight on your own? Why can't you handle your blood sugars on your own? You know, we have to look at it like a real problem that needs, that we have a solution for. We have some treatments for, at least. Maybe they're not 100%, but we have a treatment for it. Let's trust that treatment. Let's go with that.
Ryan, yeah, I mean, that's why these like medicines, all of these interventions that we could be doing aren't going out there and saving lives like across the entire country. If at the end of the day, like the AMA and the state medical boards all think that being on Suboxone is just replacing one addiction with another, and they don't want to let any healthcare professionals do it, then it's no wonder that like these misinformed, stigmatizing biases aren't actually going away, no matter how much like research and advocacy people do.
Okay, well, that's, we decided what needs to be fixed, and it should be fixed by, I expect this to be fixed by the end of the week, people, listeners out there. But us on the show, it is our time to close. I've kept you guys long enough. I really appreciate both you guys coming on and your perspectives on this topic. Let's get some plugs in. Rax, please tell everyone where they can find you, where they can hear you, all that.
Yes. So Kaveh was reading an excerpt of my newsletter, which you can find at patreon.com/RaxKingIsDead. You can subscribe for as little as $1 a month, but what Kaveh was reading from is a little series I've been doing called The Dry Drunk Journal, which for that you have to pay a little more. I'm not giving my innermost thoughts out for $1 a month, sorry. But you can read me there. You can buy my book, which was published in 2021. That is Tacky, Love Letters to the Worst Culture We Have to Offer. I also have a book of poetry from 2018, The People's Elbow, and my podcast, Low Culture Boil. And I think that's just about it. Yes.
Great writing. Absolutely worth it. Tacky is an awesome book, and I love it. And one day I'm going to have you sign it for me. Ryan, where can people find you? Where? Don't say Twitter.
Well, it's X now.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, come on.
No, I don't know. I guess I have a YouTube channel, but I haven't done anything on there in quite a while. I'm most active on Twitter, but Ryan Marino.
The YouTube channel is excellent. I eagerly await new videos. I'm clicking on it again and again, like, what's new? Is there a new one? Is there a new one? Is there a new one? So the people want to see more Ryan Marino. We want to see you on YouTube, man. Can you get on that? Can you make that happen, please?
Yeah, I have to grow the beard back, though.
It's true. You did shave your beard. Listeners, careful listeners, usually note that I mention his beard early on in the episode and how beautiful and majestic it is. But he did shave it before this one. It's interesting. It's a look. It's a look.
I'm sorry to have missed it. The beard.
We have pictures. I'll send you some.
Yeah, if you could.
Please, if you haven't already, rate and review our show at iTunes, and follow us if you're not already doing that. I'm assuming you probably already are, but leave a review. I love reading them. Here is one from Dr. P. Williams. Says, great show. Kaveh does a great job of not only highlighting medical issues in the news or of concern for listeners, but does so for non-medical listeners so they can find value in the discussion. Aww, that's kind of my whole thing. Thank you. That's like my whole shtick right there, summed up. Thank you for doing that. Please leave reviews. I love reading them. They warm the cold cackles of my heart. Thank you to Nadine for help with production. And thank you guys both so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.